These are stories that you need to know about today. Why is Epic Fury becoming an epic mistake for the United States and for Israel? I'm going to explain it to you. There's a new poll out that says Americans think Mr. Trump has gone to war with Iran. Why? A, national security. B, nukes. C, Epstein. D, Israel. What do you think they said? And we'll see countries like Qatar, diversity, their alliances away from the West, given what's happening with this war. Will they be able to diversify? I'll ask a member of the royal Qatari family right here on The Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. We want to start with something that's breaking as we speak. As you know, there is now a new Ayatollah in Iran. He is the son of the former Ayatollah who was assassinated by the Israelis and the United States. His name is Mojtaba Khamenei. And moments ago, he gave his very first dictate. He said a couple of different things. I think there's two headlines here that we come away with. One, he says all U.S. bases in the region should immediately be closed. He says those bases will continue to be attacked, giving signs that this thing's not going to be over anytime soon. And then he says Iran's new supreme leader goes on to say that the Strait of Hormuz must remain closed as well. You imagine what that's going to do to oil prices. Once again, he just said, and I'm reading this to you, that the Strait of Hormuz must remain closed. Exactly what that means or what the Iranians will do specifically, will they mine it? If they do, there's a lot of information coming out on that. U.S. admirals say it would take months to remove the mines, which means even when they do open it, it won't really be open. So much going on here. So once again, that's the very first statement being released by Mojtaba Khamenei. He is the son of the late Ayatollah of Iran. And if there's any other information that comes out of his comments, we'll share them with you immediately. Meanwhile, look, I've been doing a lot of interviews over the last couple of days. I mean, I'm getting a real sense that the attack on Iran that the United States calls epic fury is becoming very much more like epic mistake. It is remarkably costly. For one, $1 billion a day, they're saying, is being spent. This is according to congressional reports, and Iran's military is inflicting all kinds of damage on the U.S. military and on installations and on the GCC. And by the way, look at this headline now from the Fox Business Channel. Look at this. The U.S. has borrowed $1 trillion in the last 5 months. $1 trillion. That's more than GDP of about 10 countries combined. That's insane. And wait, weren't we told already that the United States is $38 trillion in debt? Yeah. So make it now $39 trillion in debt. I want to play something for you. It's a famous presidential quote. It's kind of a sign of the times quote, given what we're experiencing now with Iran. It's not JFK. It's not President Reagan or President Lincoln or President Washington. Someone a little different. It's another president that you may remember. Here, watch this.
There's an old saying in Tennessee, I know it's in Texas, probably in Tennessee, that says, fool me once, shame on you. If fool me, we can't get fooled again.
I could watch that a million times and never stop laughing. It's just, it is what it is. He's not a glib guy, right? He's not a real smart guy, but he was the president. And what he was trying to say makes sense. He says, you know, if you lie to somebody the first time, they're not going to trust you so much. They're not going to believe you so much the next time you tell them something, right? Well, that's kind of what's happening right now, though, in America even. Yeah, Americans don't trust what their government is telling them. The war is barely into its second week already. Americans hate the war. And they are not at all happy with this guy, the president of the United States. I looked at five polls this morning when I woke up. I looked at Quinnipiac, Real Clear Politics, YouGov, NBC. A majority of Americans are saying they are against the war and they're against the way that Mr. Trump is handling or prosecuting the war. Now, keep something in mind. That's despite the fact that those same Americans who said that in that poll are fed bold-faced lies every single day by the media about this war. They are told that Iran is a terrorist state with nuclear weapons run by crazy people who want to kill you if you're American. None of that is true. None of that is true. It's not a perfect country. It certainly has plenty of problems, and there's plenty to castigate. But those are all exaggerations or lies. One more thing. The people there are waiting for Americans to come and liberate them, and they're waiting with open arms.
By and large, the responses from Iranians that I've spoken to has been overwhelmingly in favor of the United States and Israeli action on the ground. The united call from the Iranian people on the ground is that they want the Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi to lead a transition government.
So that's typical of the U.S. media, what they just did right there. They had a woman from Israel pretending to be speaking for the people of Iran. You know what that is? That's called content manipulation and distortion. They never told you who she really was. They don't want you to know. But there's something different out there about this war, and it's good. There's a thing called alternative media. People are now not getting their news from the corporate networks like NBC and CNN and Fox. Oh, yeah, some old people still are. They're on wheelchairs. But rather than that, they're going to platforms that actually have larger audiences out there, right? And younger audiences. This is why young people are especially against this war, like 80%. This show, for example, our show right now, you know, we're reaching about 20 million people a week on different platforms. And by the way, look at where those viewers are. Look where this show is being watched. I just got this a couple hours before going on the air. I just pulled it, right? Those are the stats. They're in the United States. They're in Canada. They're in India. They're in the UK. This show. And same people, by the way, are watching Tucker and Megan and others like me. There's a lot of people out there who are doing this kind of job. And they're not CNN or Fox. And look at the ages now. Show them the ages there, Gene. Look at that. These are the ages of people that are watching this show. Now, the average CNN viewer, in case you don't know, is about 70 years old. Our viewers, look, they're right in the middle of the pack. Our biggest audience is between, 35 and 44. CNN wishes they had that audience. So in the past, Americans would rally around the lies that led to war. But now they're getting a different perspective. That's damn good. And it's a perspective that is actually more America-centric. It's not donor-centric. It's not neocon-centric. It's not Israel-centric. Right? No, it's news for and about the people who live in the country, the United States of America. And they get to hear from other Americans who disagree with the government, who normally don't get invited to be on CNN or Fox or any of these channels. They're not allowed to be on those channels. People like this guy. This is Colonel Larry Wilkerson.
I come from an administration of George W. Bush and Richard Bruce Cheney that committed war crimes that Colin Powell and his lawyer, Will Taft, and I agonized over in trying to present some message to the American people about them. This administration has committed more war crimes in the last few days than I think any country since Adolf Hitler committed. And that is an incredible condemnation of this entire process. We have bombed civilians relentlessly. We have bombed a school. We have bombed a hospital. We have struck facilities in the nature of Tehran's oil capacity that is now putting black poison all over 10 plus million people. And we are essentially not bombing ballistic missile sites and bombing war materiel. We're bombing people. We took a lesson from the IDF, if you will. We are bombing people.
We are bombing people. So there is a new poll out, and I want to show it to you now. And here it is. Look at this poll. Just came out. This is unprecedented. Never thought I would see something like this in my lifetime. For the first time, a majority of Americans think the reason that the U.S. president went to war has less to do with Iran and more to do with child rapist and trafficker Jeffrey Epstein and Israel. This is a sentiment that's being expressed and reflected by millions of Americans, even some Americans who are soldiers, U.S. troops. Listen to this U.S. soldier. Listen to the story he just told that's now going viral.
During the counseling, they told me I'm under investigation as a threat to national security. When I asked for proof, like what the posts were yesterday, they refused to give it to me. And the proof they gave me are anti-Israel posts. Now, when I joined the military, I took an allegiance to support the United States of America. I did not ever take an allegiance to support Israel.
Now the poll. Here it is. 52% of American voters, right there, believe Trump went to war to cover up his relationship with Epstein. And half of American voters believe Trump is more loyal to Israel than he is to his own country. DropSite put this out, put that poll out. Who's DropSite? It's an alternative platform. As I've been saying, Americans are also getting a less biased account of what's going on in the world and what's going on with this war from places like DropSite, which means that they get to hear from people they'd never be able to hear from in the past. People like my guest last night, a brilliant weapons expert from MIT.
This war is actually the beginning of the end of American military dominance, because the Americans do not have the munitions to continue this war at the same intensity it's been going on. We, the Americans, but please don't assume that I'm supporting this.
No.
We Americans do not have a lot of munitions. And, you know, for example, they have used 800 cruise missiles at this point, is according to some of the statements I've heard.
Yeah.
Now, we produce 80 cruise missiles a year. That's our production capacity. That's 10 years of cruise missile production. So we just used up 10 years of cruise missile production in a few days in the Persian Gulf against the Iranians. We cannot sustain this.
We cannot sustain this. This guy's one of the foremost experts on ballistic missiles anywhere in the world. Massachusetts Institute of Technology. That's right, Ted Postol. He's not the only one, by the way, who I'm hearing saying things like that. Listen to what Colonel Doug McGregor just said.
When this ends, we will be finished in the Middle East. There will be no restoration of the status quo ante. We will simply get out. And everybody in the Middle East will want us out. I mean, if you're living in the Gulf right now, what have we demonstrated? We can't protect them.
Right.
Our deterrence has failed. So what good are we to them?
Here's Scott Ritter saying pretty much the same thing, essentially, right here when we had him on.
We have abandoned all those whom we claim to be our regional allies, all of the Gulf Arab states who have been buying billions of dollars of American military equipment under the pretense that the United States would be there for them in their time of crisis, are now looking around, abandoned by the United States, because we only defend one nation, and that is the nation of Israel, and we're not even doing a good job at that.
Essentially, they're all saying the same thing, that this war is going south, and going south fast, and it's going to have a vast and very long-term negative consequences on the West. What they're saying is that the world is about to change because of this war. In fact, it's changing before our very eyes, and it goes far beyond the Middle East. And what Mr. Trump has done, that may have worked for a while in Venezuela, but it seems to be failing miserably in Iran, is bound to leave a mark. And here's what makes things different this time around. Here's what Mr. Trump is doing that goes beyond what other presidents have done and what the United States has done in the past, that the world is now seeing. Number one, he has completely ignored any and all legal international norms. Not that this hasn't been done before, but he's doing it blatantly. Just, he doesn't care about Congress, doesn't even pretend to, doesn't care about the UN Security Council, doesn't care what other countries in the region think. None of it. As far as Mr. Trump is concerned, he and Israel can go it alone, and they will do whatever they want, whenever they want, and to whomever they want, and he will tell you that. Number two, eliminating other countries' leaders by arresting them or killing them. The escalation of targeted killings introduced by Israel is now being fully implemented by the United States. First time that we see this being used on leaders of countries. Yeah, in the past it was done with militant groups, etc. But now it's being used against internationally recognized heads of state, presidents and ministers and religious leaders, followed by tens of millions of people who are abducted. All right? These people are abducted or assassinated. Heads of state, right? It's medieval, right? It's crazy. It's a game changer.
Iran's formerly supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, is dead. This wretched and vile man had the blood of hundreds and even thousands of Americans on his hands and was responsible for the slaughter of countless thousands of innocent people all across many countries.
Why is it a game changer? I'll tell you why it's a game changer, these new things that the United States is doing that take it even beyond what they've done in the past. Because the world is watching. And Donald Trump, who may be really good at reading a room during a business deal where he's buying a building or he's trying to negotiate the sale of some land, he's not reading a room with some business people he's doing a deal with now. He's trying to read the world, the entire world. And here, I'm sorry, but he's out of his league. He's way over his head. Let me just say it as plainly as I can, and maybe he doesn't get this. Because notwithstanding all the chest thumping about American exceptionalism, the fact of the matter is this. The world, generally speaking, already does not trust the United States or Israel. Israel, they do not trust, maybe even hate, with a passion. Look, I wish that weren't the case. I don't want it to be the case. I want people to admire the government of the United States. I would love for people to admire the president of the United States, as they have in the past, but they just don't. So given that, is this the right time to be bombing a city like Tehran and killing 1,300 civilians, including more than 100 little girls, while they're praying? How do you think that movie is playing out right now as it's seen around the world? Here's what I would say to my friends, right? If they asked for my advice. Stop watching Fox News. Stop taking vacations in Europe next year. Go instead to Asia. Go to Africa. Go to Eastern Europe. Read their papers. Go to the Middle East. Go to Latin America, where the vast majority of the world's people live. See what they tell you. They're going to be very nice. They generally love Americans. I was in Iran. They loved me because, oh, you're American, right? But I know that was not a very good Iran accent. Apologize. But if you ask these people when you travel around the world, they'll tell you they're sick and tired. Or maybe they'll whisper it to you. They're sick and tired of the CIA and sick and tired of the U.S. military going around the world and killing, starting unnecessary wars, and putting puppets into their countries who then lead them or control them. That is, unfortunately, the truth about what the vast majority of people will tell you or will whisper to you. Even in places that are supposed to be our strategic allies, like Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and UAE and Oman and on and on. And by the way, as for the people of Iran, who apparently, according to our Congress and our leadership and our media, are dying for America to go in there and free them. Yeah? Look at these pictures. Look at these images. Those are tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of Iranians. They're honoring the deaths of those killed by the United States and Israel. People who had bombs fall into their buildings. You can see in some pictures, if you look careful, that they have the caskets laid out of the little girls who were killed in that double-top missile strike. How do you think that's going over? I mean, these are not images that are going to be broadcast by the Western media in the United States or in the UK. But whether we like it or whether we agree with it doesn't matter. This is reality. The reality caused by the bombing of Iran. Now, I want to show you something else. This is from London. Look at this. They tried to have a peaceful protest against the war that's going on in Iran, in London, and authorities banned it. He said, nope, nope, can't have it, can't do it. They say it would cause too much tension surrounding an issue. Allowing people to gather and speak their mind would cause problems. So they said, no. Protests against the war in London, banned. So what happens, right, if this war drags on and it affects not just morality and sentiment, but actually begins to affect the world's energy resources, supply chain, fertilizers for crops globally, the price of goods everywhere, even something as basic as drinking water? Because all of that, I'm telling you, is very possible or already happening. Who do you think is going to be held responsible for this? See, what this war is soon becoming or has already become is a giant Super Bowl commercial running on a loop constantly for the BRICS countries to see, for the Shanghai Alliance countries to see, for countries of the global south to watch, for countries like China and Russia and India, for whom this war is becoming an opportunity to snap up even more allies and become more popular in lieu of the differentiator. That's why a lot of people are saying this.
We have an unstable, non-constitutional regime in the United States right now. It's both impulsive, amateurish, violent, and outside of institutional control. That's why you can't figure out what just happened. Why did it happen? What does something mean? This is not the fog of war. This is the fog of government. So this is extraordinarily dangerous. There are so many opportunists in the world also. Oh, we'll join the United States on this. We'll join the United States on that. Or they're afraid of the U.S. I went through the whole Gulf region in late last year. I could see the fear and I could see the dependency.
So, Professor Sachs, how does this end? Does it end? And how does it end?
It ends when world leaders behave like world leaders, telling the United States, you have to behave. You cannot blow up the world. We won't accept it. You have to behave and you have to make sense. And you have to obey the international principles. You do not run the world. That's what world leaders need to say.
You know who's really in a quandary because of this, listening to Professor Sachs' words? The Persian Gulf countries, because they're the ones who are going to have to say these words, utter these words at some point. Because they've relied on the United States to protect them as allies. Have they? So what do they do now? Do they pull away from the West? Somewhat? A little? A lot? Do they become less reliant and dependent on the United States, for example, and the West with its ties to Israel, which most of them can't stand? Especially when you consider just how vulnerable this war has left these countries. Now, they're going to blame it on Iran. But is it Iran's fault? It's a really important conversation. That's why we're reaching out now to ask this question of a member of the royal family of Qatar. Here it is. And joining us now to discuss this is Sheikh Alanoud Al Thani, non-resident fellow at the Middle East Council on Global Affairs. She's also a political analyst that is very highly regarded, as a matter of fact. So this is a perfect opportunity, Your Highness, for us to have an open discussion about what's happening now in your country and in your region, really, and what may happen as a result of what we've seen going on. So, first of all, it is so nice of you to join us. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with what a lot of people are saying, which is this war will have a long-lasting effect on the Gulf countries, specifically Qatar, because in many ways, Qatar has had a very important security relationship with the West, with the United States, and now there's a real good chance that Qatar and other countries will rethink this position and maybe diversify a little bit more. What do you think of that?
So I think that this perspective is built on a false context or a false background that Qatar and the GCC, but Qatar more specifically, mm-hmm. is not already diversified. I think we'll... Like, I was looking at it the other day, and specifically from the military aspect, and I was actually pleasantly surprised to see just how diversified our, you know, like military equipment procurement is, as well as our diplomatic relationships, which I was aware of from the beginning. So for me, it's difficult to see how much more diversified we could possibly get here in this region. By nature of where we are, we kind of have to be diversified to be successful.
It seems to me that you're diversified from an economic standpoint. In fact, like you, I started reading on your energy and trade relations with China are very, very impressive. Your economic ties when it comes to gas and oil trade with Russia, very, very impressive. But when it comes to security specifically, you are pretty much in bed with the United States. I mean, the size of the base alone that is in Qatar, where 10,000 U.S. troops are stationed, pretty much solidify that relationship. And it has made you vulnerable. Iran is not attacking Qatar. Iran is attacking that base.
Okay, well, first let me correct that before I go back to your original question. It's not true that Iran is only attacking the base. Iran is attacking Qatar, Iran is attacking Saudi, Iran is attacking the UAE, not the bases, the countries, even though the bases were not used to attack Iran. So even just attacking the base would still be against the law and completely unacceptable. But they haven't even stopped at that. They're attacking Musa'id, they're attacking Ras Laffan, those are our energy depots. They're attacking hotels, airports, just the middle of the city. I mean, I had bombs going over my house and I'm not near anything important.
Yeah.
So it's just not true. But then in terms of we're firmly in the American camp, this camp or that camp, of course, it is not a secret that the Gulf relations with the United States are very, very strong. The Western doctrine, the Western military doctrine is until today the strongest doctrine in the world. And us, alongside with the majority of the world, we follow the Western military doctrine. So the majority of our procurement is either from the US or France or the UK or Western-aligned Asian countries. There's military, if you look at it, you have military procurement from South Korea, you have military procurement from even China, even though China is not in the Western camp. So the reality is there is a level of diversification, and even within amongst ourselves, we saw the Saudi Arabian and Pakistan military alignment. Also, Qatar has very strong relationships with Turkey. So I just don't agree with the premise that we're only aligned with the West, even though we're very good friends with them.
Okay, well, then let me ask you this, because you just said something which was very interesting. You said you yourself feel somewhat vulnerable because there have been attacks near you and that they're all coming from Iran. And I take your point, and I really thank you, Your Highness, for explaining that to us. And, you know, my condolences to you and your family and anybody who's been affected by this in your country. This is a horrible situation. But you kind of have an agreement with my country, the United States of America, that we would give you these amazing missile defense systems that would protect any and all incoming ballistic missiles from hitting your country. That has not been the case. The ballistic missiles from Iran have been hitting your country, as you just stated. So what happened to the promise that you were going to be protected by all of these anti-defense missile systems like the THAAD and the Patriot that were supposed to do that, and how disappointed are you?
So I actually, so there's a distinction I'd like to make between being targeted by missiles and being struck by missiles.
Uh-huh.
As of right now, you know, thankfully, There have been no successful strikes, at least on the civilian side. So there have been attempted strikes on the airport. They have been thwarted. There have been attempted strikes. I think the Prime Minister of Qatar, His Excellency, had posted just recently about the percentages. It was only 35% that was going to military like places, and then the rest was going to all the civilian infrastructure. But the rate of interceptions has been quite incredible. I think one of the best rates of interceptions that we've seen so far in Qatar. The drones are a little bit more tricky, but that's just because that's the nature of the air defense systems. Drones are a new development, and so the technology is still being developed. And the latest agreements with the United States, they're not that old. They've just been a couple of months old. And, you know, people who are familiar with how long it takes for these things to be delivered and to be created, right now we do have some of the most protective defense umbrellas at the moment.
Do you blame the Iranians for this? Who do you put the blame on for this whole conflagration that we're all watching, which is a horrible thing?
So here's how I look at it personally.
Okay.
As a Qatari analyst, I've grown up here, and so I've been influenced by the Qatari and the GCC perspective on politics, which I believe is the correct way to do things. And it's just that it's not really our business. If the war itself, it's not our war, and it's not something that we have been involved in, and so it's not for me or for countries that are not involved to really decide on who started what and whose fault is what. What our concern is, why are we involved? I know who didn't start it, and I know who's not at fault. We are not at fault. The GCC didn't start it. Qatar didn't start it. Nothing came out of here. And so I'm really confused why Iran, after having built such great relations with the GCC countries, I mean, I wouldn't call them great, but a lot better than when it used to be, over the past couple of months, and we've seen so much progress towards peace, why, upon being attacked by countries that are not the GCC, have decided to specifically target GCC civilian infrastructure? That's just very confusing for everyone.
Well, because I think Iran would say, not that I speak for Iran or am defending Iran, but I think when we have conversations like this, we should present both sides. Iran would say it's the only real way that we can defend ourselves against the United States and punish them for trying to punish us. In other words, they're saying we're going to hit you where you live. The United States lives in Qatar, in Saudi Arabia, in UAE. That's where they have their bases. That's where they have their economic relationships. And I think when I spoke to Minister Arachi not long ago, and then about a week ago, I spoke to his deputy as well, he essentially told me the same thing. He said this was really their only recourse. Otherwise, they had nothing else that they could do. So that's their explanation. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Sure, yeah. I do know that that is their explanation. That's what I've been hearing from them. I just don't think it makes very much sense. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's not true that it's their only recourse. The attacks have come out of somewhere, just not the GCC. And so I just don't think that it's true that that's their only recourse. But even if it was their only recourse, that's their military capability. Just because that is your only recourse does not give you the right to simply attack whoever's closest to you. Especially given that an attack from their lands has not happened against you. And even if we take them at their best, let's assume that everything that they're saying is correct, that does not explain the attack on economic infrastructure and civilian infrastructure. If that were true, they would only be attacking U.S. military infrastructure. But that has not been the case. There have been deaths in the GCC from attacks on apartment buildings, from attacks on city centers. I mean, this is just unacceptable.
Yeah, no, I know. And listen, they would probably say that when they hit economic centers, as far as they're concerned, they're hitting Western economic centers, specifically U.S. economic centers. But you said something interesting a little while ago that I want to follow up on. You said that you weren't going to talk about the blame or specifically tie this to who's responsible or who did it. Let me tell you what Americans think. There's a new poll that just came out. There's two, actually. One of them just was published today in USA Today. The other one is a compilation of all the different polls that have been done. First of all, Americans tend to think that this war is not on behalf of the United States. They don't approve of this war, which is really remarkable, given it's only the second week into the war. Usually Americans, you know, get behind their president, get behind their country. But new polls are showing voters disapprove of this war in Iran, and they disapprove of Mr. Trump's handling of the war. And if you think that's surprising, which I think it is, by the way, usually Americans, even during the Iraq War, were all gung-ho. But then as time passed, they said, no, this is terrible. When asked by pollsters why you think this war took place, a majority of Americans think it had nothing to do with the United States and everything to do with Israel. And more importantly, they actually think the attack on Iran was used as a distraction so people wouldn't be thinking about Epstein or relations that perhaps this administration or this president had with Jeffrey Epstein, which, as you know, is somebody who was involved in trafficking young girls and raping young girls. That's what Americans are blaming it on. What do you make of that?
So here's the thing. I think that it's wonderful for populations to be very involved in their country's decisions and their country's politics and to be very informed. From my perspective, here's what I think it's about. I mean, we've been warning since the October 7th attacks that the Israeli response was so over the top,
yes,
and so disproportionate that it became obvious to anyone who was paying attention that this was definitely going to spill over into the region. Mm. The rate at which they were going and the extreme violence that they were using became extremely obvious that it was going to spill over into the region, especially when they started involving Lebanon, especially when they started involving Syria, who did not attack them. And then especially when us in Qatar, we got bombed by Israel, yeah, at some point.
Yeah.
We were literally mediating.
We have the video. Hey, Gene, can you put that video up? Show people that video when Qatar was doing something which was extremely respectful. They were trying to bring sides together to bring peace to the region, and instead they got bombed. This is crazy. Look, there's the pictures now. This must have been a dreadful day for you and your compatriots.
Oh my God. So many people, mommy,
look at that. Please continue, Your Highness.
Yes, and so it was a dreadful day, and we had actually a death on our side, a young Qatari officer. And so from that time, we were warning again and again and again, if this continues at this rate, it will necessarily spill over into the rest of the region and cause chaos. Mm. What's unfortunate is it seems that from the Israeli side, that kind of was the point, and that the chaos and making sure that it continued and making sure that it spilled over into the region, as per Benjamin Netanyahu's its own remarks that he's going to reshape the Middle East, it seemed that was kind of the long-term goal. And so that's my own perspective on what's going on.
Well, if Netanyahu is the brains, then the United States, my country, is the muscle. It's the enforcer. Here's what a very respected military man and analyst like yourself, Colonel Doug McGregor, said that this will lead to, if it continues this way, with Israel and the United States doing what it's doing in the GCC countries, including Iran. Go ahead.
When this war ends, people like me, who are Americans, are out. We are not going to be allowed to reset bases in the Middle East. We're not going to be allowed to stage military power in the Middle East directed at Iran or anybody else. It's not going to happen. How can we accept that? I think we can accept it very easily because I have a different perspective. I think the world is better off when we're not basing troops on foreign soil. I've never liked it. I think it's a bad idea. I'm happy to get out. But in Washington, where everything is mortgaged to vanity, especially with the president, how does he accept that without saying, well, we've been defeated?
He's a really smart man. And I think that's really important what he's saying, that We Americans have gotten used to just going all over the world and putting up bases. And we put up those bases, but when we do that, we have created a relationship, sometimes good, sometimes not so good, with people in that region. And it's always like a hammer. It's like a hammer that's, you know, above people's heads, knowing that at any moment they can kind of get hit with it. And, you know, comparatively speaking, you know, China has its Belt and Road Initiative, and Russia's reaching out to countries in, for example, Africa, and they're trying to do it through economic means. And I think what the colonel is saying is maybe it's not such a good idea to just go all over the world and have some 800, 900 different bases, and that in the end, that's not a healthy relationship that brings about. My words, by the way, there. What do you think of that?
So I think that there is generally a misunderstanding about the purpose of bases around the world. I mean, at least I can speak for what's going on in the GCC, because that's what I've analyzed myself. I've not looked at so many other countries.
Uh-huh.
But for countries that are aligned with Western military doctrine, bases play a vital role in easing logistics, in being a landing space for the new military equipment that is being received, for joint trainings, and of course, in some cases, when necessary, for joint operations. And so it's not so black and white. I think maybe his explanation for it was a little bit simplistic. And so that's been our side of the relationship with the United States, but there's also been a relationship with the UK, with France, and so on. And we use our bases, whether they're the base that has the US soldiers on it, or our own bases that don't have U.S. soldiers on it, they're used to ease military operations. And Qatar, despite having so many bases, whether it's Qatari or non-Qatari, has never started an attack on any other country in its more than 250-year history.
No question. Qatar is one of the most peaceful countries in the region, economically viable, wonderful people, smart. Everything is a positive. The only problem and the counter I would have to you, Your Highness, is this. When you allow the United States to put a base in your country, you're basically inviting Israel into your country. Because if, as we established a while ago, the United States, and especially under Trump, more than any other president in my lifetime, is the muscle. The U.S. military is Bibi Netanyahu's muscle. He uses it as he pleases. He says, he points and they go. Like, you know, a German shepherd, I guess. That means you have Bibi Netanyahu's forces tool in your country, and so do a lot of those other countries. I can't imagine that they're not at least rethinking whether that's a good thing or not, or whether they should try to unalign or realign that relationship somehow. No?
So here's the thing. The U.S. is a country that's hundreds of years old. And Israel is a country that is 80 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so the relationship between the U.S. and other countries and the relationship between Israel and other countries are two completely separate things. We don't view them as a singular entity. Our relationship with the U.S. has withstood the test of time for many, many years. And it's been a separate from any, you know, there's been many disagreements between Qatar and Israel. And that's never been influenced or never has influenced our relationship with the U.S. because the U.S. is a country of more than 300 million people,
yeah,
with its own history and culture and military doctrine and future. And so who knows what relationships look like today and what they look like tomorrow. But what it seems like is that the relationship with the GCC and the U.S. as well, I hope, for me, as someone who loves to have, you know, good relations with everyone and to be, you know, a partner for peace with everyone, I hope that our relationship with everyone can also last.
Yeah, you seem that way. You seem like a very cogent, peaceful person. And it's you're a delight to talk to, by the way.
Thanks.
Yeah, you're so good at putting these thoughts together. So let me ask you this then, based on what you just said. The world is shifting. We used to live in a completely unipolar world, completely run by the United States, the United States banking system, the United States currency, the United States military, the United States everything, right? Suddenly, we see something happening here. The global South is becoming empowered. The BRICS countries, right? the countries that are part of the Shanghai Initiative. Those kinds of countries are coming together and saying, hey, we've got a bigger standing army, we've got bigger GDP, we've got bigger populations, and when you put us all together, South Africa, India, Russia, China, Brazil, I could go on and on, they're really a force to be reckoned with. And this thing that's happening in the world right now is the West wants to preserve what it's always had. The new global South is trying to say, hey, we're here too, and you better respect us. A lot of people are saying this behavior by Mr. Trump attacking Iran this way is not respectful. But where does Qatar find its place in that evolving, transformative world?
So this is, I mean, this is a tale as old as time. You know, we had Fukuyama come and tell us that we're in the end of history. And I guess some people believed it, but you're never really at the end of history unless the world has ended. And the world clearly has not. And so there's always going to be a clash of civilization. There's always going to be, you know, countries that are competing. And we hope, you know, it's a good competition. We hope it's a competition that leads to more prosperity rather than, you know, obviously we never support violence. And then for the rest of the countries, I don't actually agree with the context that only when a country becomes powerful and rises in the world do we need to have relations with them. Hmm. I think actually, at least in Qatar, Qatar basically follows the path of maintaining relations with all countries, whether that country has a lot of influence in the world, a massive, large military, or whether that country sticks to itself and is not very militarily active, just because we think it's important to engage with everyone. And that's kind of what I've seen has been the GCC path, especially in the past 10 to 15 years. And so I think that we've been engaging, for example, let's say with China or with Russia since forever. Huh. And so it's not just because now that they have, you know, had a lot of economic prosperity or maybe built up their militaries. And I actually, from my personal perspective, is I think that's the path forward for everyone, to always engage, always keep paths open, because you never know what the future might hold for the world and when those relationships might play a vital role in peace.
Let me tell you something my mother taught me ever since I was a little boy. She said, son, tell me who you hang around with, and I will tell you who you are. And right now, in the world, most people think Israel is a vile country that is committing a genocide. The vast majority of people and countries all over the world believe that. Would you feel comfortable aligning yourself with a country like Israel that is considered that way globally?
For Qatar, I think we've never been really aligned with Israel. And I think especially, maybe a lot of countries weren't paying so much attention to Israel, but I went on an interview a couple of months ago, and I was explaining that Israel has kind of become radioactive.
Yeah.
In its relationship with a lot of countries. And I think probably on the US side, there's been a lot of investment in that relationship. And so it's difficult at this stage when Israel has, you know, behaved in such a way that's made it difficult for its allies. I think Iran is behaving in a similar way right now, where it's so radioactive, it's behaving so erratically that it's kind of become a liability to a lot of its allies. And that's the problem with choosing, violence and chaos as your path forward and choosing to be a bully. I mean, it never works, first of all. You know, Israel tried to bully us out of the mediation. It didn't work. Iran's going to try to bully us out of having relationships with whoever we want to have relationships with. I predict that it's not going to work.
Yeah.
Because that's just not the path forward. It's not a respectful way to deal with your peers.
Well, I mean, I don't want to belabor this point, but in fairness to Iran, not that I'm carrying water for them, they were attacked. They didn't attack anybody. They were trying
not
to have
by us.
No, I know. I take your point. You're saying, yeah, they weren't attacked, but they've now attacked us, and we didn't attack them. So I guess another one of my mother's great advice is two wrongs don't make a right. Let's talk.
I mean, they've made the claim. that they've been attacked from our from our lands, but they haven't mentioned which lands, and they haven't given any evidence. And every single GCC country plus Jordan has denied that claim.
Yeah.
And so you can't just make, you know, willy-nilly claims and then kill people because of it.
Here's what's going to happen, though, and here's what is happening. At least by my estimation, if there are mines in the Strait of Hormuz and in parts of the Persian Gulf, then the United States has to put in minesweepers. Yesterday, I heard from an admiral who said it'll take at least a month, maybe two, for those minesweepers to get rid of the mines. I talked to a Saudi official the other day. He said they can hold out in terms of oil for 36 days before their ships are going to come back empty and they're not going to be able to get back in. Same situation for a lot of the Gulf countries. Qatar is probably one of the most foremost places in the world for LNG. LNG is vital right now for the rest of the world. What do you think the situation is going to be? And I'm sure you're looking at this every day, as smart as you are, and given that you have an economic background and a political background, what do you think is going to happen in the Persian Gulf if this thing continues? And even if it doesn't, to oil supplies, trade routes, LNG, etc.
Sure. So I was speaking about the mines issue from last week, but my prediction was as such. It was that when Iran gets to a point where they genuinely feel like they are at an existential threat, they may deploy their mine strategy. And the reason being is if they believe that they can get back to being in power and they can get back to you know, business as usual, they will not put mines in the Strait of Hormuz because they use the Strait of Hormuz. And putting mines in the Strait of Hormuz basically renders it useless. And it's very expensive to remove them, and it's very laborious to remove them, and it takes a very long time.
Yes.
And so if they're ramping that up and they're going for it, then for me, I read that as them reaching a stage in this conflict where they believe that they are at an existential threat and that they may not have a use for the Strait of Hormuz in the future, because this affects them just as much as it affects everyone else. So that's from the Strait of Hormuz and the mines side of it. But from the side of disruption to the supply lines, I actually, for me, this is the number one issue, because it can cause a lot of human suffering.
Yeah.
And that's what we don't want to see. It's not just interrupting the flow of energy. It's also going to be impacting people's food supplies via fertilizers. It's going to be impacting semiconductors. It's going to be impacting energy, as we already know. There's so the supply chain today is so intricate, and a lot of people don't realize that the GCC has been the rock through so many crises, that has been the source of stability through so many crises, from COVID to wars to all sorts of instability. The GCC has never once been able to fill that gap, and this is the first time we're seeing that. I don't think a lot of people were factoring in just how much of that impact is going to be.
And it will be impacted. Both oil, you mentioned fertilizer, 30% of the world's fertilizer goes through the Strait of Hormuz. That's farmers all over the world. That's everything having to do with food production, growth. That's important. Drinking water, oil, LNG. I mean, this is a big part of the global trade route that affects the economy of countries all over the world. And it's starting to look like it's going to be affected. Maybe the question is how much. I don't know if you want to weigh in on that.
Sure, yeah. Just that, I'll give you one last comment before I have to go.
Yeah.
On this matter. The level of effect that we're going to be seeing if we don't stop. I mean, let's assume that we stop today. And the war ends and we restart the production, that's going to be around 4.5 decrease in the total output of the energy that we're seeing from this region for the year. If we just wait another month, that triples. So it's going to be around a 15% decrease in the total output for the year.
Wow.
That cascading effect it's actually something we've never seen before. So it's impossible to genuinely predict with details just how many sectors this is going to touch, especially that it's not just energy, it's sulfate, which we get our copper, we get our cobalt from. It's going to impact our semiconductors, electronics, mm-hmm. hospitals, airports, all sorts of things. And so I hope it doesn't get to that. I mean, we're already sort of there, but I really hope that we can backtrack and get a reach a solution on the negotiating table as quickly as possible, just to avoid the human suffering that's going to come from this all around the world.
Yeah, and that's a message that you're sending out to Mr. Trump, to Mr. Netanyahu, and to Mr. Pereshkian, that they need to get this thing over with because it's affecting the entire world.
The only way that wars have ended, no matter how long they've gone for, all wars have ended on the negotiating table. We're just hoping that we can get there as quickly as possible so that we can decrease human suffering around the world. And so we make sure that we're not, you know, wrecking, you know, some people's life, whether in the region or elsewhere. But until then, Iran does need to stop attacking us because we have nothing to do with this.
Your Highness, it's such a delight to talk to you. You're so transparent. You're so easy to talk to. You're so good at formulating your thoughts. And I really have enjoyed it. And speaking on behalf of the millions of people all over the world who are watching this interview, I'm sure they're thanking you as well for sharing, sharing your perspective. And perhaps in the future, you and I will have a chance to have another interview, maybe in Doha, as I can get a better understanding of what your country is. Thank you, Your Highness.
Thank you so much.
No, thank you. It's very kind of you to join us. So, and now we want to thank you for joining us once again. It has been a very hectic week. We've brought you interviews with people from Saudi Arabia, from Iran, the United States. What we're trying to do is give you a collective experience of what people in different countries and in different parts of the world are saying about this unique situation and dangerous situation that we find ourselves in right now. So many tens of millions of you are watching and engaged and writing to us and telling us what you think. Thanks once again. Thanks for being with us. You can find us, as I always like to say, on several new platforms, BitChute, Spotify, YouTube, X, all of those places. Go there, watch what we do, watch what we say, and tell us what we're doing wrong. I'm Rick Sanchez. Thank you once again for letting us into your homes, and we'll be looking for you next time.